When we're dealing with the evolutionary, alleged evolutionary origin of fishes, or apes, or man, or reptiles, at least there is some historical evidence that is available, should be available. So we can test the evolutionary hypothesis or prediction versus the historical record or the fossil record. There is some way then, at least some way, that we can test evolution or creation. But when it comes to the origin of life, there is no way whatsoever. If chemical evolution occurred and we've had an organic compound arise on the face of the earth, these compounds would subsequently have been metabolized by the bacteria and algae and other organisms that arose and would have been destroyed. Be no historical evidence whatsoever remaining of the origin of life, even if it did occur by evolution. Theories that deal with the origin of life are outside the scientific domain, absolutely outside the scientific domain. Theories that deal with the origin of the universe are outside of science. There is no way to go back and rewind or unwind or see this happen. There's no way to reconstruct or observe the origin of the universe, the origin of life. There's no way to test these processes. Scientifically, there may be all different theories. There are a variety of theories on the origin of the universe. How are you ever going to decide which one is right? No one has ever observed the origin of the universe. No one observed the origin of life. No one had the faintest idea which idea was right. J.D. Bernal was a British evolutionist. Peter T. Mora is an evolutionist, American. And Bernal, in discussing one of Mora's publication, said that Mora was right, Peter T. Mora, Dr. Mora was right when he said that theories that deal with origins lie outside of the scientific domain. Now here's an evolutionist saying that it's right. When you deal with the theories on the origin of the universe or the origin of life, this is not science. But yet the evolutionists insist that creation be excluded, because it allegedly is not a scientific theory, but the same evolutionists demand that theories that deal with the origin of the universe and the origin of life be included in our science books. Because these are scientific theories, they say. Look, they're no more scientific than creation, as we outlined yesterday. But they are more materialistic, that's true. That does not make them more scientific. After all, let's contrast the Christian view of Christmas to the Santa Claus view. Now, we would have to admit that the Santa Claus theory is more materialistic than the Christian view. After all, Santa Claus is allegedly a human being. He is physical. And the chimneys he climbed down are physical chimneys, and the toys he delivered are physical things. And you might be able to construct some theory about Santa Claus that deals with the physical. Now, when we speak of the incarnation of God in a human being, this is beyond physical test. And it might be that the Santa Claus theory of Christmas is more materialistic and mechanistic and naturalistic than the Christian view of Christmas. But I don't think it's any more scientific. And the idea that life has evolved is certainly no more scientific than the biblical proclamation that God created living things. Man will be forever speculating what may have happened or what could have happened when it comes to the origin of life, but scientifically he will never know what happened. What actually did happen, he will never know. Not as long as we are on this earth. But you know, someday we will know. Someday we will have the privilege of sitting in God's classes in biology and geology and astronomy and so forth and so on, and he's going to tell us all these things. And I'm sure we're going to sit there with our mouth open and say, wow, wow, really, is that the way it happened? The atheistic, naturalistic, mechanistic evolutionist who's claimed desperately that he wants to know how all this happened, he's never going to find out. He's going to have his ideas and his theories and his speculation, but he's never going to really know. But we are. And all of the so-called simple Bible-believing Christians. Are there any other kind besides Bible-believing Christians? I don't think there are. But anyhow, we are going to have the privilege of knowing how God really did create life. But scientifically, there is no basis for investigating the origin of life. And I say that all speculation, all theories, all experiments allegedly related to the origin of life are outside of science. We'll never be able to know how God did it by scientific processes. Now, of course, most people, or I should say all people, working in this area, the origin of life area, are led by the conviction that God had nothing to do with it, that there were no supernatural intervention necessary. Now, you can see if God was involved or if he were necessary at any point in the origin of life, you can't investigate it. You can't go in the laboratory and investigate such a process. If God was involved or necessary in any way in the origin of life, it lies outside the scientific domain. On that criteria alone, it lies outside the scientific domain because it is not observable, not testable. But in any case, you can't postulate theistic evolution. You can't go in the laboratory and study a theistic view of the origin of life. No way. Because if God was involved, then it's no longer mechanistic or naturalist. So the people who published all these books and articles, of course, assume that God was not involved in any way. Now, the old idea in the origin of life was, well, they used to think that frogs, just all of a sudden, here were frogs, just spontaneously came to life from swamps. They thought that decaying matter spontaneously gave rise to flies and maggots and so forth. And rats, all of a sudden, here were rats alive out of decaying debris and so forth and so on. This was an idea that was widely accepted. And it took at least 200 years of scientific experiment to disprove this idea of the spontaneous generation of life. They proved that rats and flies did not come spontaneously into being through a series of experiments. Well, the final claim was that microorganisms came spontaneously into being. The French Academy of Science offered a large prize to the scientist who could finally prove or disprove the spontaneous generation of life, and Louis Pasteur won the prize. He demonstrated that the spontaneous generation of life was impossible. But you know, scientists still believe in the spontaneous generation of life. They don't believe that swamps spontaneously give rise to frogs, or that decaying matter gives rise to flies, but it just took hundreds of millions of years of time. You start with primitive gases, and over hundreds of millions of years, perhaps, they slowly gave rise to a great quantity of simple organic compounds, and then these relatively simple organic compounds slowly and gradually gave rise to an ocean full of proteins and DNA and RNA, and then these macromolecules slowly accumulated into systems. The systems accumulated and got more and more complex, and finally the first cell arose. Hundreds of millions of years involved in the slow, gradual evolution of life. Well, I'm going to close right there, and we're going to consider these models tomorrow, or this afternoon. This afternoon, at 1:15, we'll resume this lecture. Let me just say this, in closing. They're not saying that life spontaneously arose in the say that swamps all of a sudden gave rise to frogs, or that decaying matter spontaneously gives rise to flies. They're postulating that it just took a long period of time. They're saying, for instance, if you say a frog gave rise to a prince, and this was an instantaneous process, you know, somebody kisses a frog and becomes a prince, something like that, that this is equal to a fable or a fairy tale. But if you say a frog was converted into a prince, but it took 300 million years, that's equal to science. So you see, all you have to do is convert A fable into science is to throw in 300 million years. And that's the way it works. All right, let's take a break.
Okay, now, let's get back to our story on the origin of life. I want to show that first slide, please. Now, in considering the origin of life, the evolutionist must consider a series of postulates. He must try to reconstruct this origin of life step by step. Now, in theories, speculations dealing with the origin of life, one must first reconstruct what he thinks the primitive Earth must have been like. He must construct a model for the primitive Earth. He must attempt to decide, for instance, what gases were in the primitive atmosphere, what energy sources were available, what the pH of the ocean was, the temperature of the ocean, and other factors, conditions in the crust, and so forth and so on. He must try to imagine what that primitive Earth was like. Then after he has constructed his primitive Earth model, he must try to imagine or reconstruct how relatively simple organic compounds may have arisen. Point two here in our outline. He must try to imagine under these conditions how these relatively simple compounds could have formed and accumulated on the primitive Earth. Now, after he thinks he's got an ocean full of these relatively simple compounds, he must try to imagine, or he must be prepared to postulate, how these simple organic compounds could have combined to form the complex organic chemical molecule, the protein, the DNA, RNA, the complex carbohydrates, so forth and so on. The origin of the macromolecule. Macro means large, of course. So macromolecules refers to these very large and complex molecules, protein, DNA, RNA, and so forth. Now, after he thinks he's succeeded in obtaining an ocean full of these complex macromolecules, the proteins, DNA, and RNA, and so forth and so on, he must try to imagine how out of this vast soup, so to speak, these complex organic chemical molecules became associated into systems. Because if you're going to have something that's going to develop into life, you must get these molecules working together in metabolic systems, coordinated in time and space. After now he's got this operating, finally then he must imagine some process which would allow increasing complexity, additions to these systems, so that the systems became more and more complex until finally the first cell came into being, a unit that would be completely independent, self-maintaining, developing, growing, and a self-replicating entity. Some entity that would be completely independent, self-maintaining, self-replicating unit, which would be the first cell. Now, we're going to go through this step by step. Let us consider, first of all, the nature of the primitive Earth. Now, let us emphasize, first of all, nobody has the foggiest notion, really, based upon sound, solid scientific evidence, what that primitive Earth was like. Now, we believe that there was a primitive Earth. We believe that primitive Earth existed very briefly. Earth was form and void, without form and void during the creation period, but it was a very brief time. Now, the evolutionists, on the other hand, believe that this primitive Earth existed for hundreds of millions of years. What was the nature of this primitive Earth? What was it like? Well, of course, they have no real scientific data. In the early work on the origin of life, the people assumed that this primitive Earth contained an atmosphere similar to our own. Our atmosphere today is an oxidizing atmosphere. That's one of the keys. Oxidizing. Our atmosphere contains free oxygen. We know that iron, rust, things will combust or burn because of their oxidation by the oxygen of the air. Our present atmosphere consists mainly of nitrogen and oxygen. You take nitrogen and oxygen, that's just about 100% of everything that we have in our atmosphere. The other constituents are minor. We have, of course, water vapor. You take all the water vapor we have in the entire atmosphere out to the far reaches of space, and you condense it, and you would have about a 3/4 to 1.5 inches and a half of water. If it was evenly distributed around the Earth, it would amount to about a 3/4 to 1.5 inches and a half of water. But we do have some, of course, aqueous vapor and carbon dioxide, and then minor amounts of carbon monoxide and argon and other gases. But the main constituents of our atmosphere, of course, nitrogen and oxygen, water vapor, carbon dioxide. Now, the early people working in this field assumed that the primitive Earth had such an atmosphere, and they conducted a few experiments using gases of this kind. However, a smart organic chemist came along, or a physical chemist, came along and said, "Now, wait a minute, fellas. Could never have happened this way. The type of chemical compounds that we have in living cells could never have spontaneously arisen in the presence of oxygen. You see, in these compounds that we have in our bodies, for instance, in the fats, we have the fatty acids, and they have these long chains, carbon containing carbon and hydrogen. And finally, we have a carboxyl group here joined to the sugar, or glycerols, actually a sugar-like compound. But we have this long chain fatty acids. Some of these chains are 14 carbon atoms long, some 16, some 18, so forth and so on. And in the amino acids, we may have some of these chains of this kind. They have this carbon and hydrogen in them, as well as the amino group and carboxyl group. Now, you see here, carbon is combined with hydrogen, as well as having a carbon-carbon bond. Now, this type of compound will not arise spontaneously in the presence of oxygen, because oxygen will, for instance, combine with methane to get carbon dioxide and water. And this will happen relatively rapidly speaking, relatively rapid compared to these other chemical reactions, and you would end up with all carbon dioxide and water. You would not end up with this type of compound. These would be spontaneously oxidized by oxygen, just as oxygen spontaneously combines with iron to form rust, and will combine with wood to burn the carbon containing compounds to carbon dioxide and water. So if any compound like this tended to arise in the primitive ocean or atmosphere, it would be oxidized by the oxygen of the air, and you'd never end up with anything like this. So the origin of life in an oxidizing atmosphere is a thermodynamic impossibility. It could never happen. So, being apprised of this evidence, the evolution says, presto. The world, the primitive ocean, the primitive Earth, must have had a reducing atmosphere. Instead of having free oxygen, it had hydrogen. And carbon, instead of being in the presence of carbon, in a form of carbon dioxide, was in the form of methane, CH4. We had carbon in the form of methane, perhaps some carbon monoxide. We had free hydrogen, See, free hydrogen cannot exist in the presence of oxygen because it will be oxidized to water. But exclude oxygen, then you can have some free hydrogen, and you can have some nitrogen combined with hydrogen in the form of ammonia. This will not exist in the presence of oxygen. It would be oxidized to nitrogen plus water. And, of course, there'd be some water vapor, for here the oxygen is combined with hydrogen. So, they said, the primitive Earth must have had a reducing atmosphere. No free oxygen, but, on the other hand, hydrogen. And carbon combined with hydrogen. Now, actually, the man who proposed this was a Russian biochemist. Now, Dr. Oparin, the Russian biochemist, did not examine all the evidence he could find from geochemistry, analysis of the rocks, and take the oxidation reduction potentials or balance sheets or something like that, and say, now, on the basis of this data, it appears that primitive Earth must have had a reducing atmosphere. No, he did no such thing. He said, the origin of life requires a reducing atmosphere. Therefore, the primitive Earth had a reducing atmosphere. Methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and so forth and so on. So, he proceeded on the basis of this assumption, and most of the origin of life experiments that have been conducted the last 10 or 20 or 30 years have been based upon this hypothetical methane ammonia atmosphere. Methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and so forth. Well, do we have any evidence that the Earth ever had a reducing atmosphere? No, we have no evidence. At a National Academy of Science symposium on the origin of the Earth's atmosphere, one of the geologists was present with Dr. C.F. Davidson. Davidson said that as far as he could see, as far as he could determine, the Earth never had anything else but an oxidizing atmosphere. Dr. Abelson, who's director of the Carnegie Institute in Washington, D.C., a geochemist, published a paper in 1966 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, in which he said, there is not only no evidence that the Earth ever had a methane ammonia atmosphere, but there is much evidence against it. And he details some of this evidence. I think it's contained in my monograph. I refer to the paper by Dr. Abelson and some of the facts that he pointed out. He said there's no evidence that the Earth ever had a methane ammonia atmosphere. He published his paper in 1966, 7 years ago. But people didn't pay any attention to it. I used to see many recent papers in which the researcher went in the laboratory, postulated a methane ammonia atmosphere, and was used methane, ammonia, and other gases in his apparatus, conducting his experiments happily, merrily, ignoring the facts. When you're having fun in the laboratory, why pay any attention to the fact? And so it goes. The game goes on. But Dr. Abelson presented good, solid scientific facts mitigating against such an atmosphere. Now, Abelson himself is an evolutionist. He has to have a reducing atmosphere. So he postulated an atmosphere in which there was no methane, but carbon monoxide, some hydrogen, no ammonia, but in the place of ammonia, he postulates nitrogen and water vapor, of course. Now, if you study Dr. Abelson's paper, though, you'll find out that he just had to make one assumption after another in order to get his atmosphere. And so, any of these people, when they postulate an atmosphere of this kind, they might as well just say in the beginning, we assume that the Earth had a primitive atmosphere and just forget about it. Why try to justify it? Why go through all these calculations? Because he has to make one assumption after another. And his whole paper ends up an assumption. Might as well say the primitive Earth had to have a reducing atmosphere with the origin of life, so we know it must have had. That's what it amounts to. But actually, there is good evidence. Well, let's put it this way. First of all, there is no evidence that the Earth ever had a reducing atmosphere. And as far as we can determine, you look at the rocks and the nature of these rocks, there is no evidence that the Earth ever had anything but an oxidizing atmosphere. Now, this is critical because right at that point alone, we could exclude the origin of life. You've got to have a reducing atmosphere. You can't have free oxygen in the atmosphere and have the origin of life. Now, there is some additional evidence accumulating that the Earth must have had an oxidizing atmosphere from the very beginning, or soon after its origin. If you are assuming an evolutionary origin of the solar system and of the Earth, you still come face to face with the fact that the Earth would have had an oxidizing atmosphere, would have had oxygen in its atmosphere. Now, what is the source of the oxygen in our atmosphere? Now, the geologist and others have assumed in the past that our oxygen that we have in the atmosphere must have been from photosynthesis. Is that in the beginning, there was no oxygen. And so how do we account for all this oxygen that we have? Well, from photosynthetic organisms. When an organism finally evolved that could take the carbon dioxide from the air and convert it to carbon plus oxygen, or it's just more involved in that. But anyhow, when oxygen was released, then this oxygen began to accumulate. So the oxygen we have in our atmosphere today is from photosynthesis, they say. However, there is another mechanism that can account for the presence of oxygen. Water in the upper reaches of the atmosphere is decomposed by ultraviolet light into hydrogen plus oxygen. More, the mechanism is more involved in this. But in any case, water is decomposed or broken down by ultraviolet light into hydrogen plus oxygen. Now, hydrogen has an atomic weight of 1. So molecular hydrogen would have a weight of 2. Atomic oxygen have a weight of 16, so molecular oxygen would have a weight of 32. 16 times as heavy. The oxygen is 16 times as heavy as the hydrogen. Now, hydrogen, because it's so light, these molecules can reach an escape velocity. They can reach a speed sufficient to escape the gravitational pull of the Earth. And these molecules diffuse out into the universe, out in the solar system, and out in the universe. And they are lost from the atmosphere of the Earth. The oxygen is too heavy. It cannot escape the gravitational field of the Earth. It is retained. So, as water is decomposed by ultraviolet light, the hydrogen escapes, the oxygen is retained. And so oxygen builds up in our atmosphere from this decomposition of water. Now, how fast would this oxygen accumulate on the primitive Earth? Would it take hundreds of millions of years, or would it build up rapidly? Now, some geologists made some calculations, and according to Berkner and Marshall, two geologists, they said that this reaction would proceed at such a rate that oxygen would not accumulate in the atmosphere until very late in the Earth's history. Notice practically no oxygen during these hundreds of millions and billions of years, here down to this time, way after life could have evolved, hundreds of millions of years later, eventually the oxygen begins to accumulate significant quantities. Brinkman published a paper in the last few years in which he said that Berkner and Marshall are mistaken. Their assumptions were invalid. Some of the assumptions they made about the absorption of ultraviolet light by oxygen, self-absorption, and so forth and so on, is that they made a mistake. And I think Brinkman was shown to be right. And Brinkman said that oxygen would have accumulated very early in the history of the earth that this reaction would have produced a significant quantity of oxygen very early in the earth's history, far before life could have evolved. I think, it was in New Scientist or Scientist Digest, one of these science magazines reported on this paper by Brinkman and headlined it, Theoretical Blow to the Origin of Life. Theoretical Blow to Theories on the Origin of Life. And they said, if Brinkman is right, then life could not have evolved. If you produce large quantities of oxygen very early in the Earth's history, then, of course, life could not have evolved. Now, I think Brinkman is absolutely right on this. And I think one of the Apollo flights, was it Apollo 15, 16, one of these Apollo flights placed a camera on the moon. The astronaut, American astronaut, placed a camera on the moon with film that is sensitive to ultraviolet light. And they photographed the Earth. And they show, and these photographs, here's the Earth, shows tremendous quantities of hydrogen surrounding the Earth, diffusing out into the outer atmosphere. Now, if you got all of that hydrogen diffusing away, that means the oxygen would be retained. And Carruthers was his name, the naval research scientist, said that it is apparent, or it seems, that the oxygen we have in the atmosphere was not produced by photosynthesis, but was produced by this reaction. So I think that certainly is support for Brinkman. Now, if all of this is true, then it seems that right here at the very start, before we even get into the chemistry of these organic compounds, the evolution of life would have been impossible. You see? The first assumption of evolution is that life exists. Okay, I'll go along with that assumption. The second assumption is that life evolved. That's where we disagree. But in any case, they say life exists, therefore life evolved. The evolution of life required a reducing atmosphere, therefore the primitive Earth had a reducing atmosphere. That's a series of assumptions that they make. But, you see, if we take four, that the primitive Earth did not have a reducing atmosphere, then the evolution of life is impossible. Even before we get into the chemistry of these organic compounds, we believe the evidence indicates that the evolution of life would have been an impossibility. All right. Setting aside all of this discussion now and evidence, let's assume that the Earth really did have a reducing atmosphere. Let's assume that there was plenty of methane, ammonia, and hydrogen, and carbon monoxide. The conditions were right for the origin of life. Let's consider some of the other problems involved in the origin of life. Under these conditions, would huge amounts of these relatively simple compounds evolve or arise? Now, we have to have huge quantities of these compounds, amino acids, the purines and pyrimidines, which make up part of the DNA and RNA, the sugars, which make up part of DNA and RNA, as well as the complex carbohydrates. We have to have huge quantities of this stuff. Let's examine some of the possible mechanisms for their origin. Knowing that we have to produce huge quantities, the present ocean contains 350 million cubic miles of water. 350 million cubic miles of water. Now, in order to have a significant concentration, that means you've got to have many billions of tons of this stuff. We're not talking about trace quantities. We're not talking about minor amounts. We're talking about billions and billions and billions of tons. Now, in order for life to evolve, the primitive ocean would have to be full of amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. They're compounds similar to this, and the carboxyl group of one amino acid will combine with the amino group of one of the other amino acids in order to produce Well, here it'd be a dipeptide. But this carboxyl group, in turn, can combine with the amino group of another amino acid. And we get a tripeptide. I'm just going to draw in the side chain as an R here. And then this carboxyl group, in turn, can combine with another amino group of another amino acid. And so it goes head to tail, and you can get these long chains on down the line, so forth and so on. Many of these amino acids, subunits, combine to form proteins. Now, in order to explain the origin of the proteins in, we've got to have an ocean full of amino acids. Well, we've got to have more than proteins, obviously. We've got to have DNA and RNA and carbohydrate. So in order to explain the origin of the DNA, we've got to have the building blocks for DNA and RNA. We've got to have some of these nucleotides, and I'll show a slide of that shortly. The nucleotides include these complex bases, purines and pyrimidines. They're not really simple compounds, are they? They're very complex, really. We call them relatively simple. You go in the laboratory and try to make one from scratch, and you'll find out it's a real hard job. But in order to have the DNA and RNA, we've got to have the purines and pyrimidines. We've got to have sugars. Here in this case, we have ribose. We've got to have deoxyribose for the DNA, ribose for the RNA, combined with the base. We've got to have phosphoric acid. Got to have many other organic compounds. Now, the question is, could these relatively simple organic compounds form spontaneously and naturally in huge quantities under the assumed conditions of the primitive Earth? Well, one may say, after all, these are relatively simple compounds. There was plenty of energy available, the ultraviolet light of the sun, electrical discharges, and so forth and so on. All right. Plenty of primitive gases, plenty of energy. Why not assume the formation of these relatively simple compounds and go to a more difficult phase of the problem? Well, actually, we believe there are insuperable barriers to the accumulation of even these relatively simple compounds. Insuperable barriers. What made their origin or their accumulation in significant quantities absolutely impossible under the assumed condition of the primitive Earth? Even the most favorable conditions that are assumed having been present on the primitive Earth. Now, one of the first problems is this. We do not have an infinite quantity of material available. We have a limited quantity. And we run into difficulties because of this. Now, you see, there are 350 million cubic miles of water in the primitive or in the present ocean, and even if the primitive ocean had only 10% as much water, that's still 35 million cubic miles of water. Now, in order to have a significant quantity of a chemical in there, we've got to have a huge quantity of one particular compound. If you're going to have a significant quantity of alanine, the amino acid called alanine, you've got to have billions of tons of alanine. It doesn't make any difference how much other stuff you've got in there. If you're going to have a significant quantity of alanine, you've got to have billions of tons of this alanine. Now, you can have all the billions of tons of alanine you want, but that won't help out glutamic acid. If you're going to have a significant quantity of glutamic acid, you've got to have billions and billions of tons of glutamic acid. That applies to all of these organic compounds. But if we would take all of the nitrogen in the present atmosphere, we take all of this nitrogen now and put it in the form of a single nitrogen-containing compound. Let's assume, for instance, we put all of it in the form of glycine, this relatively simple amino acid. All of the nitrogen in our present atmosphere in the form of a single organic chemical compound, in this case, glycine, dissolve it in the present ocean, our concentration would be 2/10 molar. Now, the quantity 2/10 molar does not mean anything to a non-chemist. I know you don't know what a mole is, a molar quantity. Well, I can say a mole is this. If you take all the numbers here, hydrogen is 1, that's 2 hydrogen, 4 hydrogen. Take that, nitrogen is 14. Take that, we've got 2 carbons. Carbons are 12 each, that would be 24. Oxygen is 16, we've got 2 of those, that's 32. Add all of that up, 6, 4 is 10, 14. We've got 74. Does that come out right? We've got two more. How many more hydrogen? 2 more? 1. All right, 75. That's right. Glycine is 75. All right, now 75 grams of glycine is 1 mole. 75 grams. That's how we get this mole business. You understand that now? So 75 grams equal 1 mole. 2/10 mole, be 2/10 of that, it'd be 15 grams. Now, 2/10 molar solution is 15 grams per liter. That makes sense? Well, anyhow, let me say this. You take all of the nitrogen, put it in the form of a single compound, dissolve it in a present ocean, you come out with 2/10 molar. You know, that's about the concentration that these original life chemists were. About 2/10 molar. Maybe 1/10 molar, 2/10 molar, 3/10 molar. But in order to get a 2/10 molar solution of glycine, you'd have to take all of the nitrogen and put it in only glycine. But of course, all of the nitrogen would not be in the form of chemical compound. Most of it would be in the atmosphere as nitrogen. Maybe if you would be real generous, you could say that about 0.001% of the nitrogen of the atmosphere would be in the form of chemical compound. Well, that reduces our concentration to 0.002 molar. Now, that's not much. That's far below the level at which these people work. But, of course, that nitrogen is not going to be in the form of one compound. After all, you got all of this chemical evolution going on. You got all kinds of chemical compounds formed. You got amino acids being formed. You got these pyrimidines and purines being formed. They contain all kinds of nitrogen. You got to spread this nitrogen around all among a great variety of different compounds. Maybe 1,000 different compounds. Maybe 1,000,000. Let's say 1,000. Well, that reduces our concentration of nitrogen containing this. Way down to very low. This is no longer significant. You can't have life evolving in quantities of that nature. That's too small. You see, you've got to take this nitrogen and spread it around or among a large number of compounds. That doesn't leave much for anyone. Let me see if I can illustrate it this way. I have 2 sons. Now, if I had about $10,000, I could give each one of my 2 sons $5,000. Well, he could go out and buy a pretty nice automobile and still have enough money left for a tank of... Well, I don't know if he could have enough money left for a tank of gas or not, today's prices. I used to say that, but I'm not so sure anymore. Well, anyhow, maybe he'd get a tank of gas out of it. But supposing I had 10,000 sons, I could only give each one a dollar. Well, a boy can't even take a girl out on a date on a dollar anymore. Reminds me of Dagwood Bumstead. He said he finally found out what the generation gap is. He said his son came to him and said, "Dad, I need $5. I'm going to take my girl out tonight." He said, "Now, when I was a young man," he says, "I could take my girl out on a dollar." He says, "It's obvious that the generation gap is $4. Well, supposing I had 100,000 sons, I could only give each one of them a dime. You see, that's insignificant. And that's the problem here. You've got to take the quantities of material available and spread it out among a large number of compounds, dissolve it in a huge quantity of water. That doesn't leave enough for any one compound. Even if you had a very efficient method of synthesis, assuming that you had an efficient method of synthesis, you still would have to spread this around so many different compounds that you never accumulate one in a significant quantity. Now, here's just another example. We have carbon. You can have different arrangement of putting these carbon atoms together, forming the carbon atoms. They'll form carbon-carbon bonds. You can have that long chain arrangement. You can have the middle arrangement. You can have this highly branched arrangement. You can arrange 20 carbon atoms in many different ways. How many different ways do you think you can arrange 20 carbon atoms? Well, let me make a little deal here. I'll give you a week. I'll give you 7 days, seven 24-hour days. Now, the computer is out. Nobody can use a computer. But if you take a pencil and paper, and different ways you can raise 20 carbon atoms, you can do that in a week, I'll give you $10,000. But if you fail, you give me $1. Anybody want to take up that proposition? What do you have to lose? One lousy dollar. But if you succeed, you get $10,000. Anybody want to engage in that little exercise? Well, if there are 75 people here at the end of the week, I'd have $75. Because there are over 1 million different ways. Obviously, if you could figure it out, you still wouldn't be able to do it physically in 1 week. Take more than 1 week to figure, just to draw out all these million different ways. Just think of that, over 1 million different ways. Now, what are we trying to say? You see, in chemical evolution, unguided by direction or purpose or design, when anything and everything happens, you get all this tremendous variety of chemical compounds being formed. You would never have a significant quantity of any one. That's assuming an efficient method of synthesis. Do we have an efficient method of synthesis? Here's the apparatus used by Stanley Miller in his experiment on the origin of life. This was performed in 1953. It was published in 1953. And on the basis of this experiment, the evolutionist said, at last we have established a plausible basis for the chemical origin of life. This classic experiment of Miller have demonstrated that these organic chemical compounds could have formed under our presumed primitive earth condition. Well, let's see just exactly what Dr. Miller did. Here's a picture of the apparatus that he used. You notice that he assumed that the primitive earth would have the gases of hydrogen, water, ammonia, and methane. He put these gases in his apparatus. He provided an energy source. He provided an electrical discharge up there in that discharge chamber. Now, most of the energy that would have been available on the primitive Earth would have been from ultraviolet light. But some would have been available from electrical discharges, a little simpler to construct such an apparatus. So Dr. Miller assumed that the energy source here was electrical discharge. He had these gases. So you have the gases, you have the energy, and he allowed this apparatus to operate for about 2 weeks' time. You notice that he has a condenser here. The moisture is condensed, collects here in the trap, and any product form will collect here in this trap. So after a couple of weeks, then, he took the solution in the trap, he analyzed it, and lo and behold, here was some glycine, alanine, a few of the amino acids were detected, as well as some of the other relatively simple compounds that make up part of the living cell. So the whole scientific world went wild and said that Stanley Miller had established a plausible basis for the origin of life. Now, point number one. What Miller accomplished in the first place was of a most trivial nature. After all, there is a world of difference between amino acids and a living cell. A living cell is an incomprehensible, incredibly complex organization made up of many complex structures and thousands of very complex macromolecules arranged in highly coordinated metabolic systems. What relevance do the few amino acids have to such a very complex system? Suppose we have a pile of bricks out here in the parking lot. Would that demonstrate that we could construct a building? That a building could have come spontaneously into being? Because we could somehow get a few bricks to come spontaneously into existence? Would that demonstrate that this building would come into being? Well, of course, it would demonstrate no such thing. There's a world of difference between a pile of bricks and this building. This building not only includes bricks, but notice the very specific arrangement of those bricks. They're brought together and are cemented together by mortar. We have girders, steel girders, and wood, and all kinds of material, and electrical systems, and plumbing, and so forth and so on. Highly arranged in a very specific system or arrangement. Now, this building is incredibly crude compared to a living cell. So we got a few amino acids. So what? I'd be surprised if you didn't get something like that. That doesn't say you're going to get a living cell. So what he accomplished was very trivial, and that would not have been possible unless he used something that was extremely artificial and would never have been possible on the primitive earth. Dr. Miller put a trap in his apparatus. Well, why did he put this trap in there? Well, he never would have succeeded. He never would have got any product, any detectable amount of product, without that trap. The reason is this. If those products, if those amino acids and other products came into contact with the electrical discharge, they would be destroyed. They would be broken down. And the rate of destruction of these compounds would far exceed the rate of synthesis. He would have accumulated no significant quantity of product if those products came in contact with this energy source. You see, you have the starting materials combined to form the product. At a certain rate, I'm going to draw it this way. The rate of destruction of these products, however, would far exceed the rate of formation. Actually, you would not exactly go back to starting materials. These products would be destroyed, would go to other products, primitive, simple gases, and their rate of destruction would far exceed their rate of synthesis. The ultraviolet light, the electrical discharge, is much more efficient in destroying the product than it is than they are in forming the product. So the overall net result would be an undetectable amount of product. Well, now Stanley Miller succeeded. But unfortunately, there were no organic chemists on the primitive earth. There were no organic chemical apparatus, no system to bring this about. And under those conditions, no product would form. Here is the picture of the primitive earth conditions, supposedly, that gave rise to these compounds. We find the gases that are postulated, methane, ammonia, carbon monoxide, hydrogen, and so forth and so on. We have the energy source available, electrical discharge, ultraviolet light. Under these conditions, supposedly, these relatively simple compounds are formed. They come settle out of the atmosphere into the ocean, and eventually give rise to amino acids, so forth and so on. Now, the hooker is this. Those compounds form in the atmosphere, and it takes a long time for them to settle out and reach the ocean. The half time of fallout is about 3 years. That means if you have 1 pound of, say, glycine formed, it takes 3 years for a half a pound of this to reach the ocean. And then in another 3 years, half of the half would reach the earth, another quarter of a pound. So the half time here is 3 years. Now that's a long time. While all that is going on, the electrical discharge of the violet light is working, acting on this glycine and destroying it. Now, in 1960, a man named Hall published an article in Nature magazine. You'll find this reference in my phonograph. Dr. Hall published a paper in which he pointed out the flaw in Miller's experiment, pointed out the fact that Miller used a trap. He says, when you take into account not only the rate of synthesis, but the rate of destruction, you find that no significant quantity of these products would ever form on the primitive earth. Take glycine, for instance. Glycine is the simplest amino acid. Very relatively simple in structure. Simply has an amino group, just two hydrogen on the carbon, and the carboxyl group. Now, in the case of glycine, the rate of formation is the most efficient of all the amino acids because it's the simplest amino acid. Its rate of destruction is the slowest because it's very simple, absorbs relatively less of the ultraviolet light. But he said, even in the case of glycine, 97% would be destroyed before it ever reached the surface of the ocean. And even after it reached the surface of the ocean, because ultraviolet light does penetrate the ocean to 20 or 30 meters, because the ocean is always stirred, the half-life of this glycine would be something like 20 or 30 years. And that is infinitesimal compared to the hundreds of millions of years they need to accumulate this stuff. So he said, the overall result would be that you would have a quantity of glycine that would be equal to about 10 to the minus 14th, I think, somewhere to 10 to the minus 24th molar. That is insignificant. Insignificant. But take something more complex. Take something like glucose. Glycine has two carbon atoms. Glucose has six carbon atoms. It forms much more slowly and is destroyed much more rapidly. He says you take glucose and you would have a concentration of about 10 to the minus 134th molar. How little is that? Take the entire universe, assume that it's 5 billion light years on a side, fill it full of water, dissolve that quantity of glucose in this entire universe, and you'd have a hard time finding one single molecule. That's how small that is. Hall said, when you take all of these factors into consideration, his conclusion is the following. The physical chemist, guided by the proved principles of chemical thermodynamics, notice what he said, the physical chemist, not guided by what he hopes could be, or what he'd like to have, or what the evolutionist needs, he says, the physical chemist, guided by the proved principles of chemical thermodynamics and kinetics, cannot offer any encouragement to the biochemist, speaking of the origin of life people here, who needs an ocean full of organic compounds to form even lifeless coacervates. Coacervate is that globular oily material that separates out of a solution when you reach a certain concentration. Coacervate is not a living thing, obviously, just a globular mass. He says, even to form this, you need an ocean full of organic compounds, and there is just no way. When you take into account these proven principles of chemical thermodynamics and kinetics, there is no way that significant quantities of these compounds would ever accumulate, because their rate of destruction would exceed the rate of synthesis. Now, you see, the very energy source that is required for their synthesis will destroy them. Now, one said, well, maybe we could filter out this ultraviolet light. We could exclude the electrical discharge somehow where that compound is not destroyed. Aha! But you never get the compound synthesized either, because that energy is necessary for the synthesis or the formation of these compounds. Long as you've got that energy there, it'll destroy them. Remove the ozone from our atmosphere, allow the ultraviolet light to come into our atmosphere, and we would die very, very soon. A microorganism, bacterial cell, its average lifetime would be about 1 second. You remove that ozone, so you do not filter out the ultraviolet light of the sun, and you'd kill everything up on the earth. Why would all of these living forms die? Because ultraviolet light breaks chemical bonds, it destroys chemical compounds, and would destroy life. That's why you want to sterilize something, you radiate it with ultraviolet light, play ultraviolet light on it, and you'll kill the bacteria. You'll kill all the organisms because that ultraviolet light breaks down chemical bonds and destroys life. Now, please, get this concept in your mind. It's very important that these organic chemical compounds would be destroyed much more rapidly than they would form. Therefore, they could never accumulate in a significant quantity in the primitive ocean. And the origin of life would have been an impossibility, right at this relatively primitive state. All right. But, forget all that. Let's assume we had an ocean full of amino acids, purines and pyrimidines, sugars and so forth. Could life have evolved in spite of this difficulty? Oh, I forgot to mention another difficulty or two. Dr. Abelson pointed out in this 1966 paper that amino acids and sugars react chemically to destroy one another. You take an amino acid like glycine, and if you had a sugar present, you've got these chemical groupings. I want to draw it the other way. You've got a sugar here. I'll just draw this one group in. The oxygen combines with the hydrogen, forms water. You get a chemical bond between the sugar and the hydrogen. I mean, the sugar and the amino acid. Kaput. Neither one is of use anymore in the origin of life. They would destroy one another. They'd take each other out. The tackle would take out the lineman, or the opposing lineman, or the end here. The sugar would take out the amino acid. The amino acid takes out the sugar. They're no longer of any use in the origin of life. This would happen naturally and spontaneously in the primitive earth. So even if you could get sugars and amino acids, they would react with one another and destroy one another. Well, now look. They assume the amino acid exceed the quantity of sugar. That means you destroyed all your sugar. But without sugar, you don't have any DNA and RNA. Without sugar, you don't have any carbohydrate. So you see, you're dead. Now, one origin of life chemist goes in the laboratory and he constructs conditions and gives him amino acids. Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. We solved the solution or the problem of the origin of amino acids. Another chemist, he goes in the laboratory with different conditions, he gets sugars. Wonderful. They say, now we've got sugars. But they forget this all happens in one great big gemisch in this primitive ocean. There's no organic chemist there to isolate one from the other. They all form together. One knocks out the other and you're dead. But these people, they don't pay any attention to this. Abelson pointed this out in 1966, and I've never seen anybody worry about it. Another problem is, and Abelson pointed this out, that phosphoric acid forms insoluble salts with calcium and magnesium. Calcium and magnesium, calcium phosphate, and magnesium phosphate is insoluble. It goes right down to the bottom of the ocean. You have much more magnesium and calcium available when you do phosphoric acid, so you have no phosphoric acid. But without phosphoric acid, you can't form DNA and RNA, because phosphate is part of the DNA and RNA. So what do? Again, evolution is dead. All right, but in spite of all these difficulties, let's assume we've got plenty of sugars and amino acids and phosphate somewhere around. Somehow they respect each other and all this doesn't happen. But now we come to one of the real big problems, one of the insuperable problems of the origin of life. You see, the problem is this. When amino acids combine to form protein, when they form these long chains, you see a protein is a long chain. One amino acid combines with the other. Most of these proteins have several hundred of these amino acids chemically combined, one with the other. You notice here in this small section of the protein, you have the carboxyl group of one, combined with the amino group of this one. Here, the carboxyl group of that is combined with the amino group of there. We have all of these so-called peptide bonds. Well, in order to form that chemical bond, you have to put energy into those chemical compounds. You have to feed energy into them. Now, therefore, these chemical bonds do not form spontaneously. They tend to break apart and release that chemical energy. The natural tendency, the spontaneous thing that happens, is that these chemical bonds break and release their energy. The natural thing, you see, is for proteins to break down and release the amino acids. There is no natural tendency for these amino acids to combine and form the proteins. We have the same problem in the DNA. Here's a section of DNA. Notice that we have a sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar. That's the backbone of DNA and RNA. A sugar, phosphate chain. Now, the way you get the specificity of a DNA and RNA molecule is the order of these so-called purines and pyrimidines. Specific order of these bases. Here we have thymine, then guanine, then cytosine, then adenine. Now in DNA, we might have thymine, adenine, thymine. Or we have all kinds of specific ways these bases are arranged along the chain. Now the specific arrangement of these bases is what spells out the genetic language. Just as we have a message here in the English language spelled out by these letters, so we have a message spelled out in the gene or the DNA by the specific order of these bases. We're going to come to that in a minute. That's another real big hooker. Every time we consider the next step, we find that the problem gets deeper and deeper and worse and worse. But right now, we want to consider how these chemical bonds form. You see, they do not form spontaneously. To form those chemical bonds, say, between the sugar and this base, this chemical bond here, or the chemical bond between the sugar and the phosphate, those chemical bonds, the formation of those chemical bonds, requires energy. You have to put energy into those chemical bonds. As a result, the natural tendency is for the polymer to break down to release the monomers. The tendency is for the protein to break down and release the amino acids. The tendency is for the DNA and the RNA to break apart and release the nucleotide. This is the overwhelming tendency this way. Now, evolution has to go this way. So they have to supply some mechanism or some source of energy, some specific energy, some specific application of energy that will make these monomers combine and go this way against the natural tendency to break down. Now, tomorrow morning, we will finish this lecture and we will review one of the theories, one of the widely accepted theories on how the proteins were formed, how things went the other way. And we will expose the fallacies and the weaknesses in this model and show how ridiculous really it is. There is really no solution to this problem. There's a thermodynamic barrier. You see, you've got to make water flow uphill. Now, the natural tendency is for water to go downhill. Now, you can make water go uphill and deliver it in a certain way if you have a pipeline, if you have a pump, and if you have energy. But in order to get that water to go uphill to a certain point, you have to have a pump, you have to supply it with energy, and you have to have a pipeline. Now, how on the primitive Earth did we have mechanisms with directed energy in a certain way so that we'd have things go this way when the natural tendency is to go the other way? Well, the evolutionists really have no solution to that, and we believe no solution is possible. But we'll go into that in detail tomorrow. All right, let's take a break, and then we'll reassemble shortly for our panel, our question-answer discussion.
That's safe.
Regards to light, I'm having a conceptual problem here, how light probably not occurred.